Today is Tuesday, October 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, thousands took to the streets in Hong Kong as China celebrated its 70th anniversary as protesters violently clashed with police. Also ahead, new reports that U.S. President Donald Trump pressured other leaders beyond Ukraine, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he has a plan for Brexit. All those stories and more coming up next. Hong Kong police shot a protester at close range, leaving him bleeding from his shoulder and howling on the ground in a fearsome escalation of anti-government demonstrations that spread across the semi-autonomous Chinese territory on Tuesday. Hong Kong's hospital authority have said that the individual is in critical condition. Hong Kong protesters also threw gasoline bombs and police fired tear gas in street battles across the city. The unrest came in stark contrast to the celebrations, marches, and fireworks on mainland China to mark the 70th anniversary of the founding of the modern People's Republic of China. VOA's Brian Patton is in Hong Kong and notes democracy activists are using increasingly disruptive tactics to pressure Beijing to let Hong Kong govern itself. I spoke with him earlier. Brian, the protests got extremely violent today with reports of a Hong Kong police officer shooting one of the protesters. What can you tell us about what you know about that encounter?
It's unclear the context of what happened. There is a report and that video footage has confirmed the report that a protester was shot in the chest by police firing live rounds. This would be the first time that there was this type of report that the police in Hong Kong have been using live bullets to disperse or discourage or confront the protesters here. Up until now, there has been non-lethal force, but it's been escalating over the almost 4 months that this protest movement has been in operation. There have been more recently reports of police using water cannons, pepper spray, tear gas, rubber bullets. This was the first time that we've heard about live rounds.
There was some statements put out by authorities that they expected more violent clashes during this October 1st protests. What can you tell us about what you saw throughout the day during the October 1st events?
Well, today it actually started off quite peaceful. The police had banned all protests and demonstrations today, but in defiance of that ban, political parties, democracy groups had vowed to take to the streets. And there was a major march, thousands of people marching through central Hong Kong today. And that, for the most part, went off peacefully. There were some side groups early on reported that were broken up by police or arrests, or there was tear gas used on one group. But what for those of us who are in the central part of Hong Kong, you could just see the flow of people coming by, holding umbrellas, very peaceful, seemed to be tolerated by the police. And then as the afternoon went on, we saw more and more reports of police and protesters clashing. There were some reports of protesters throwing petrol bombs or confronting with the police itself, engaging with the police, and then numerous reports of police using tear gas and pepper spray and even water cannon against the protesters. And now this one report of live rounds being used. There have been concerns over the last recent weeks that police officials have been increasingly using terms like terrorists and extremists to describe the protesters, and that they need to be treated as such.
You mentioned that we're going on 4 months of continual protest. This all started with that extradition bill that has since been pulled. Have the residents in Hong Kong expressed any kind of fatigue to you since you've been there?
There have been some who are expressing fatigue, but what we saw today, thousands and thousands more are still coming out to try to maintain the level of civil liberties that they have enjoyed here for since the handover in 1997.
Brian Patton reports for VOA. He's currently in Hong Kong. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives are moving ahead with their impeachment inquiry against U.S. President Donald Trump with subpoenas requesting documents from his personal lawyer and the Secretary of State, as well as hearings scheduled this week with former officials involved in U.S.-Ukraine policy. A whistleblower report alleges that Mr. Trump sought Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's help in digging up incriminating information about former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter that would hurt Biden's prospects of winning the Democratic presidential nomination and challenging Trump in next year's vote. The president denies any impropriety.
You have a whistleblower that reports things that were incorrect. As you know, and you probably now have figured it out, the statement I made to the president of Ukraine, a good man, a nice man, knew, was perfect. It was perfect.
Now, to bring us up to date on the latest happenings on the Hill is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, welcome to the program.
You're so welcome.
All right. There is a whole lot to unpack in just the first 2 days of this week. And I guess where I want to begin with is the subpoenas, not only to former, Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, and the State Department. So what can you tell us about that?
Right. So today has been an interesting day in terms of the subpoena to the State Department, to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who wrote back a very impassioned response to the House Foreign Affairs Committee and other committees that are seeking this information, basically saying that it's not going to happen, that those depositions that the investigators on the House side wanted to get done this week, the State Department is not going to comply with them, and that Pompeo basically said that you can't come for these career professionals at the U.S. State Department. Find a new way. Send through those subpoenas.
And this is a very long letter with each point being, you know, explained in its own paragraph. But what can you tell us about Mr. Giuliani and the subpoena for him?
So the subpoena for Giuliani went out after the Pompeo subpoena. We're going to get a whole range of these as the weeks go through, as we get closer and closer to the impeachment possible floor vote. Giuliani has said that he might possibly cooperate. We need to see how that plays out, especially now with the Pompeo subpoena being up on hold. But I think that Giuliani is a little bit more open to the idea of defending himself and has certainly said that on cable news.
They're defending himself, yes, but the questions presumably would be, you know, his activities, which he has said has been at the behest of the State Department, but he's also asking, you know, acting as the personal lawyer of the president. So there's a privilege there,
right,
beyond executive privilege as well.
Right. And which is why he said that he would need to run that by President Trump before he did anything like that. Having heard what we've been hearing from the president over this past week, I would be very surprised if President Trump gave him the go-ahead to do that.
Now, what can you tell us about the new allegations that the president also was speaking to the leaders of Australia and Italy about trying to get extra information on political foes?
Right. So in the whistleblower complaint that was released to the public last week, the whistleblower alleged that this was actually part of a pattern, that the call to the Ukrainian president wasn't just a single issue, that actually President Trump was making these kinds of offers to other foreign leaders. And now we're getting more information about that. We're learning that Attorney General Barr was involved in that. And he's actually in Rome, Italy today as we speak. So we'll be interested to see how that plays out.
Oh, very interesting. Really quickly, we have about a minute left here. You know, all this comes down to the impeachment inquiry and the vote in the House to actually impeach the president. So there's two questions I have for you. One is, has there been really any discussions as to what, if any, articles of impeachment will be drawn up? And where do, you know, people think the vote is on that coming?
Sure. So in talking to Democrats before they left for their 2-week congressional recess last Friday, the talk was really focusing on this Ukrainian issue, keeping very tight focus and drawing up maybe only 2 to 4 articles of impeachment that would keep focused on Trump's interactions with foreign leaders. Now, when we go to the House count in the vote in the House, looking at the issue very carefully is how many people will support those articles of impeachment. We know that 225 members of the House support an impeachment inquiry, but that's different from taking an actual vote on impeachment on the House floor. They would have to see the articles to know how they would vote.
And then, of course, the trial would take place in the Senate where the Republicans have the majority. Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Thank you so much for joining us today.
So welcome.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Back in 2016, astronomers from the California Institute of Technology generated excitement when they said they found evidence of a super-Earth-sized planet called Planet 9 in the far reaches of the solar system. While this mysterious planet has not been seen so far, evidence of its existence was gathered through observations of the odd orbital behavior of several Kuiper Belt objects. A pair of physicists have now put forth a new theory that perhaps the strange behavior of the Kuiper Belt objects may not be due to the existence of a mystery planet, but instead a small-sized primordial black hole, or PBH. Scientists theorize that a PBH is a type of black hole formed shortly after the Big Bang that can have a mass as small as a tiny fraction of a gram. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. October has arrived, and that is the month that Britain must leave the European Union unless another extension is granted. A delay is something Prime Minister Boris Johnson does not want. He says he will shortly also present the EU with a proposal to amend the Brexit agreement, including new ideas for dealing with the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, which is part of Britain. The latest Brexit news and political drama surrounding the Prime Minister. We're joined on the phone by reporter Henry Ridgewell in London. Henry, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Steve.
So I guess where I want to start today is what do we know about this so-called grand plan that's going to be unveiled soon?
The details are few and far between, and there's been a lot of back and forth between journalists and number 10 Downing Street, the office of the Prime Minister, today. There was a leak to the media last night that Boris Johnson's proposals would involve putting a series of sort of mini customs posts along the Ireland and the Northern Ireland border to effectively remove the need for one hard border, which is the major sticking point, and try and minimize any infrastructure along that key frontier. That was quickly rejected by Number 10 after it received short shrift from the European Union and particularly from Ireland, who said it was basically completely unacceptable. Boris Johnson is currently at his Conservative Party annual conference at the moment and has done a series of interviews today. He was questioned on those details and he just was not forthcoming. He said there would be hard proposals, generous concessions given by the UK, as he put it, to the EU in the coming days. And he said that he very much hoped there would be an agreement, a withdrawal agreement, and that a no-deal Brexit could be avoided. But as we have been for the last 3 years, we're still waiting for details on exactly what those proposals might entail, and so is Brussels. And so far, they're saying they've received nothing of sufficient detail that might remove the need for the Irish backstop.
Now, this is coming just ahead of the October 18th and 19th meetings. You know, if there isn't a deal in place by the 19th to prevent a no-deal Brexit, Prime Minister Johnson is supposed to go and ask foreign extensions, but there's some worry that he may not do that, correct?
Exactly right. He has repeatedly said that he will not ask for an extension, that come what may, the UK will leave the EU on the 31st of October. And that's leading to speculation about, well, what he might then do, because the chances of striking a deal within the next, what, have we got 10 days until that, as you say,
almost three weeks.
That summit seem very slim indeed. And so there is some speculation that he might stage a very dramatic walkout from that EU summit. Sort of suggesting that he's fighting back against an intransigent EU, and then that he might resign as prime minister and try to force the opposition to come up with an alternative government or to have a general election and then fight that election on the premise of being a leader who is trying to fulfill the wishes of the people in leaving the EU against a parliament that is just trying to block everything. As you can see, there's a lot of sort of game theory going on here about where this might lead, the different chess moves that might lead to a victory either for Boris Johnson or for the opposition, who are in some disarray themselves, because there is some talk of forming a unity government of opposition parties to oust Boris Johnson, but they just can't agree who might lead that. The Liberal Democrats, the third biggest party, say they just couldn't put up with Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, as the leader of any unity government. And so they can't agree what they want either. So we have 31 days to go until that deadline, and not one party in Britain really seems to know exactly what it wants.
Henry Ridgewell, reporting on Brexit for VOA from London. Thank you so much for your time.
Good to be with you, Steve.
North Korea's state media says Pyongyang and Washington have agreed to hold working-level talks on October 5th. The announcement, if true, would break months of stalemate since the failed summit in February. Recently, a U.S. senior administration official on background confirmed to VOA that the meeting is planned to take place sometime within the week. And this comes after former National Security Advisor John Bolton said North Korea would never give up its nuclear weapons.
I think the strategic decision that Kim Jong-un is operating through is that he will do whatever he can to keep a deliverable nuclear weapons capability and to develop and enhance it further. He may try to get relief from international sanctions. He may make some concessions. But under current circumstances, he will never give up the nuclear weapons voluntarily.
And reports that British-registered companies have also facilitated North Korean efforts to evade international sanctions have been made. Now, joining us on the phone to break things down is Bruce Klinger, Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me again.
So, Bruce, in your opinion, you know, these working-level talks were supposed to happen a long time ago. You know, what, in your opinion, has changed to facilitate discussions this week, and since just as recently at the UNGA, it sounded like, you know, they were still roads apart and trying to get things started?
Well, Kim Jong-un promised at the Singapore summit a year and a half ago that there would be working-level meetings, and there were none for 6 months. And then when they did finally deign to have them, they focused on everything except denuclearization. And then after the Panmunjom meeting between the two leaders, again, Kim promised to have these working-level meetings, and they dragged their feet. So right now we're finally convening these meetings after many, many months of promises. You know, we're really not expecting a lot, certainly not a breakthrough, because North Korea's statements recently have been very conditional, very much these meetings will continue only if the U.S. has pretty much totally changed its policy.
And that's one thing that the United States, the State Department, the White House has said, you know, until complete denuclearization comes about, you know, the sanctions are going to remain in place. And that's one thing that Pyongyang has repeatedly asked for, you know, to be removed, or at least follow the Chinese suggestion as a step-by-step progress. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think there's sort of a misperception of what the administration's policy is. It's often depicted, particularly after Hanoi, is that North Korea gets absolutely nothing until we get absolutely everything. And U.S. officials have said that's not the case. What they'd like to do is really define the parameters of an agreement, define the endpoint, very much like we did in arms control treaties with the Soviets, and then it can be implemented in stages, sort of like you want a 100-yard agreement, and then you're willing to implement it in 1, 5, 10-yard agreements. But you want to know that agreed-upon endpoint. So, you know, North Korea so far has not really indicated they're willing to go beyond just capping production of nuclear and missiles. They haven't really seemed to put on the table the existing arsenal, which is, of course, what they're required to do under 11 UN resolutions.
Well, that brings us back to almost where we were at the beginning, what the definition of denuclearization is, right? The actual endpoint that both sides need to work to.
Exactly. We really are no further along, and the working group meeting that will happen this weekend, you know, it's a positive sign to have diplomats getting together. Now, that's what diplomats do, so it's not a success in and of itself. You know, and because there's been yet another turnover on the North Korean side of negotiators, you know, this is like a first date all over again. You know, they're going to get to know each other, going to sort of understand the quirks and idiosyncrasies of the negotiators, let alone hopefully start to talk about negotiations. So, you know, we've had kind of drive-by meetings, whether working group or summit, and it really kind of resembles speed dating, where you have these very, very short get-togethers, and they usually don't lead to much.
We have about 40 seconds left here. I want to ask you about regional aspects because of the ongoing rift between South Korea and Japan, and the looking as if they're going to cease their intelligence sharing agreement, and what impact that may have on the region.
Well, that does impact it. By pulling out of what's called the JSOMIA, it makes it much more difficult to share information. It's sort of the U.S. is the operator in the middle who's holding two different phones to their ear and trying to facilitate communication. So it's not a good policy of trying to have the allies with, you know, efficiently detect or deter and defend against a common North Korean threat.
Bruce Klinger is Senior Research Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, good chatting with you again.
Steak is back on the menu, if a new scientific review is to be believed. A group of experts from around the world say that there is not a lot of evidence that red and processed meats cause cancer, diabetes, or heart disease. But Reuters' Ryan Brooks reports their study has already sparked a fierce backlash from doctors.
Worried about heart disease? Well, a new scientific review shows you might not need to pass up on that steak. The results go against years of advice from doctors when it comes to red and processed meat. Bradley Johnson at Dalhousie University in Canada co-led the review.
Based on the research, we cannot say with any certainty that eating red or processed meat causes cancer, diabetes, or heart disease.
The Canadian researchers were joined with others from Spain and Poland. They picked through data from 54,000 people who had taken part in various randomized trials. They were looking for a connection between eating meat and health outcomes. Their conclusion was, you can probably stop stressing out.
For vegetarians and those who don't eat a lot of meat, they often cite health concerns for these choices. However, the benefits of abstaining from meat are uncertain, and if they do exist, they're very small.
The review has kicked up something of a scientific food fight. A group of doctors from Harvard, Stanford, and elsewhere want it retracted on grounds of public health. And they've put together a statement saying that changing up guidelines on meat as a result of the review would be irresponsible.
That was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks. And finally, students are clicking away on their mice at the University of Staffordshire, one of several United Kingdom and U.S. schools launching programs aimed at capitalizing on the booming esports industry. In their first week of class, a group of students is playing a first-person shooter video game in a sleek new digital studio. The university last year launched its bachelor's and master's esports programs, in which students mainly learn marketing and management skills tailored to that specific industry. Other schools launched programs this fall. They include the Ohio State University in the United States and additional schools in Singapore and China. And if you're in South Korea, you can watch esports on network television, something that while I was living there, I was able to do with quite regularity. StarCraft was a big game there. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Thomas Blondet, and managing editor Kate Pound Dawson, thank you so much for listening. Now, you'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.